Welcome to Modern Sign Books on Blog Talk Radio. If you're interested in what makes your favorite authors and collectors tick, then you'll love hearing what they have to say in our live interviews. Learn how they got started writing, the books and authors that inspired them, what they have in their personal collections, and much more. Meet today's hottest authors as they discuss their life and writing in revealing conversations with our book specialist, Roger Nichols. And find us at modernsignbooks.blogspot.com. Now sit back and enjoy a few minutes with Modern Sign Books. Here's Roger.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. Our guest today is award-winning New York Times bestselling thriller author Steve Barry. He was a trial lawyer for 30 years and held elective office for 14 of those years. His books have been translated into 40 languages with 20 million copies in 51 countries. He's a member of the Smithsonian Institution Libraries Advisory Board and a founding member of the International Thriller Writers, a group of more than 2,500 thriller writers from around the world, and served 3 years as its co-president. Now, one of the delights for readers of his books are the passion for history, which infuses his work. You can count on learning a fascinating new aspect of history in every Steve Barry novel. In fact, both he and his wife, Elizabeth, are such fans. They have created History Matters, a foundation dedicated to historic preservation. Since 2009, they've raised money to save endangered historic treasures via lectures, receptions, galas, luncheons, dinners, and their popular writers' workshops. We'll be sure to talk about that before the end of the day. But our prime focus this morning is on his latest Cotton Malone thriller, The 14th Colony. We're very pleased to welcome Steve Barry. Good morning.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Yeah, you're a big success now, but it was not one of those overnight transitions. I believe you said it took you 12 years to get published?
Yeah, it was one of those overnights in 12 years. From the day I wrote my first word to the day I sold my first word was 12 years. And during that time, I wrote 8 manuscripts, and 5 managed to make their way to New York publishing houses, but they were rejected a total of 85 times. And so it was on the 86th time that one of those manuscripts got bought the second time around. So it was a very long process for me. I tell people all the time, I may not know a lot about writing, but I'm a world-class expert on rejection.
And it has served you well, apparently. But also, I have read in one of the interviews you said that part of it is timing and knowing what's in style or fashion.
Yeah, that's the only reason. The only way I got published was the world changed. You know, I was writing what used to be called a spy thriller, and in 1991, that genre died when the Soviet Union collapsed. So, by the mid 90s, the genre was gone, and by 2000, it was forgotten and buried and just gone completely. And then the Da Vinci Code came along in 2003 and reinvented the genre and brought it back, but not as a spy novel, but as action, history, secrets, conspiracies, international settings. It became that, and that's exactly what I had been writing. And so Random House was looking for something to go along with Da Vinci Code, and I got bought in 2002 when they bought Da Vinci to go along with it. So for me, I was in the right place, right time, right story on the 86th time.
Wow. I feel like I'm talking to Robert the Bruce and watching the spider rebuild the web over and over again. The 14th Colony, and I have to say, you mix everything, and I feel like a Ginsu knife ad there. Wait, that's not all. You get history from the Cold War, the War of 1812. Mm-hmm. You get a famous 5th century Roman honored for both what he did and what he didn't do. You get a pope, a president, a premier, Dolly Madison, a lake containing a fifth of the world's freshwater, a secret compartment, and a problem with an amendment to the Constitution. I just have to ask how you keep all of these plot elements organized.
Just do it the very highly technical way. I just take a piece of paper and I write them down in an outline form. It's just the simplest way to do it. The old ways work best. And I've never used high-tech stuff when it comes to plotting. I found that just a simple piece of paper does the trick just fine, and I just keep it straight in that regard. I do a rough outline of what I want this book to be, and then I unfortunately can't do a detailed outline. I wish I could. It would actually makes the writing go a lot faster.
Oh, yeah.
But I try to outline about 50 pages ahead of myself in some detail. So I stay about 50 ahead, but I always catch up because outlining takes longer than the writing. And I just kind of keep it straight that way in a simple way. And then, of course, I'm rereading the book constantly, so I'm making adjustments constantly. See, I write a little different than other writers. I write 50 pages, and then I edit those. I write 50 more, and I edit 100. I write 50 more, and I edit 150, and then I keep doing that. So by the time I'm done to the last 50, the first part, the other 400 or so have been gone through 30 or 40 times. And as I'm going through, I'm making those adjustments constantly in things that come in the research and things that are adjusted and things that are there. If I could outline all the way through before I wrote, I would already have dealt with all of that. But unfortunately, right, there's just not time.
Well, also, that makes for an opening that, I will say, sucks the reader right in and go, oh, what's going on here? And I think whatever you're doing, keep it up, because it's working very well.
Thank you. I have a prologue always in the novels, and those are historical. Yeah. And they have to have a punch to them as well. But then my chapter one has to have a punch too. So I have to have a double punch when the book starts. That's the thing about a prologue. It's got to have a punch to it. And this one does in this book because of the meeting with John Paul and Ronald Reagan, which actually happened in June of 1982.
You know, this is fascinating. And President Reagan here comes off very well. And I think at one point, because I love taking notes as I go through, and at one point you talk about thanks to an actor who many shrugged off as incompetent and ineffectual, but that actor knew the value of a good show. You have that in one of the characters' mouths, but somehow I feel that might actually be the author's opinion there.
Well, it wasn't. That is actually not my words. Those are actually the actual words of someone who served in the Reagan administration.
Oh.
So I actually used his words there that I came across. They were very prophetic, and Reagan did. He understood that, and he played a great show when it came to the Soviet Union. He ran a bluff with them. It was a monumental bluff, a brilliant bluff, and it worked. And it drove them to bankruptcy, and you have to give him credit. He knew how to play. You can, no matter whether you liked Reagan or didn't like Reagan, or you agreed with him or didn't, the one thing that history will give him credit for is that's bringing down the Soviet Union.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah. And he will get his credit for that, yes, along with John Paul II.
Right. I think, I was looking for one of the other quotes here. You're using both money and morality. I thought that was an interesting combination.
Money and morality, always a problem, always comes into play, and you have to think those two through. They can be a great contradiction, and the novel explores a little bit of that contradiction, yes.
Yeah. I early in the book, you write about Cotton Malone. He loved flying and had a talent for controlling machinery and motion, and I wonder if that might serve as a description of you as the author.
I don't fly. I fly. I don't know how to fly a plane, but I would say that I do like to have control of things. Yes, my wife would say I might be a little obsessive compulsive, but I don't think I'm that bad. Any good trial lawyer's got to be in control of things. I mean, that's part of that, you know. And I was a trial lawyer for many years, and you want to be as in control as you can. And a novelist has to as well. You can't let this thing get out of control. You have to keep, you know. You got to keep a tight rein on it. So, yeah, there's a little bit of that description would apply to me, yeah. And, of course, I am Cotton, basically. I created him from my personality, so he's pretty much me. And so there's a lot of me in Cotton.
I'm glad to hear that, because I would love to meet him, and apparently I am right now. So that's excellent.
Kind of, pretty much. I mean, I don't jump out of the planes or fly them backwards like he does and those cool things. But as far as his personality goes, and particularly his fears and other things, the fear that we deal with in this book is one him and I share. And you know, the fear that he has to confront head on in this novel is something that we share together. So there's a lot of me there.
Great. Well, I will join you in that. That's one of my particular phobias. So,
yeah, and I've experienced that too. So when I wrote those scenes, they were particularly they hit home here. I mean, I had to, you know, when you're writing and you're wincing a little bit, like, oh man, I remember that. That ain't good.
Yeah.
You know, that's not, there's nothing good about that happening there. And you know, but I wanted to explore that fear with Cotton. and I wanted the reader to explore it, and I wanted, you know, that vulnerability to be exposed. The thing about it, though, it's only exposed to the one person that he loves. Mm-hmm. And so it's an intimate moment for them when they, that they're sharing there. You know, she realizes she's seeing his worst fear come out, and he's allowing it to come out. That's a lot for Cotton to do, because emotions are tough for him to show.
And there are some really satisfying emotional openings up in this book, which I think longtime readers will really appreciate.
And I did it on purpose, because I broke them up in Lincoln Myth, and it was really bad. And then Cassiopeia was not in Patriot Thread. And then I brought her back in this book, and she'll stay now. And I did. There was some things. They had to wrestle with a few things. And I don't want to put that off to any reader who's never read me before. If you've never read me before, you will get everything I'm saying immediately in the novel, because I write the books where you don't have to read another book to understand what's going on in this one. But these two people are beginning to trust one another and beginning to really depend on one another, and it's tough for them. You know, these are loners, and it's very hard for them to do. As I said, my personality is Cotton, and my wife Elizabeth's personality is basically Cassiopeia, so it's basically her and I in that novel.
How does she feel about all that?
She likes it. She has no problem with it. She likes Cassiopeia, and so she doesn't have a problem with her personalities going in there. And her and I would only know this, but there are some of the conversations that Cassiopeia and Cotton have are literally our own words. but only her and I would know that.
I just have this feeling. I just have this thought that maybe one day she'll walk in and looking at the manuscript and saying, "You know, Cassiopeia would never do that." Meaning, I would never do that.
Oh, she's done that before. Oh no, that's already happened. When she said, "She don't need to say that. She doesn't. She needs to do it." And she's the one who decreed that Cotton would be monogamous. Because I had never intended on Cotton being monogamous. I wanted him to have a different interest in each book, because it's just more fun for the novelist that way, mm-hmm. and gives me a lot more freedom. But she decreed that he would be monogamous, and so that's how that all came about.
And wise and long-term husbands know enough to listen in those cases.
I didn't even argue with her. I just said, okay. Exactly. Okay. I didn't even argue with it. I did break them up, though, in Lincoln Myth, and didn't tell her until she read the manuscript. And she didn't like that at all. But I assured her that there's a reason, and we're going to deal with that in a couple of books from now.
And that's interesting to have a story arc this long. Was this just number 11, is it, if I'm counted right?
It's 11th Cotton Malone. Yes,
yeah.
Correct.
And to have the relationships developing and changing and mutating over time, it occurs to me that one of the things that you do very well is transition.
I try to. I'm very conscious about that, and I'm also very conscious that I don't want it to be where you're lost. Mm. I don't want you to pick up. I've actually had people read my books backwards, and they've said they've had no problem with it. They've read the series backward in reverse. They said, I had no problem with it whatsoever. And that was a great compliment. It's good to hear that. I write, you know, the trick to writing a series is every book in the series has to be the same but different.
Yeah.
The same but different. That's a tall order to make that. And so I'm very conscious of that. But there is an arc in there. And there are evolutions of the characters. And they are evolving. And you know, that's just life, and that's the way it should be. You can't keep everybody the same. It would get extremely dull and boring. And then in one book, I killed off one of my major characters. That's about the only time I've had something that's kind of out of sequence in some respects, where I killed off a character. But it was something that had to be done. And so I'm very conscious about writing that where the books, it's a world, but it's not a world that you will feel like you're lost in if you come in at a particular point other than the beginning.
Setting the book, this one, at the time that the control of government changes hands, I believe adds a unique set of tensions to the novel. It was a very unusual setting.
Well, I wanted that. I got the idea of this book 3 years ago, and I filed it away because I knew I wanted to do it this year.
Mm-hmm.
So it was intentionally done for this year because I knew that the presidential race would be heating up and it would be on everybody's mind, and this book would come out at the height of the primary season.
Right.
So, you know, and so it worked out, you know, that was intentional. And then I wanted to explore this moment. You know, the Americans are really good at changing power. We do that really well. do that maybe better than anybody on the planet. That the most powerful person in the world at 12 noon on January 20th is no more. You know, the Constitution says that, the 20th Amendment says at 12 noon on January 20th, you are no longer president, period. It doesn't say the new guy takes over. It just says you're no longer president. The question is, who takes over for you? And there's where the problem comes with the flaws in the 20th Amendment, the flaws in the 1947 Presidential Succession Act. And I wanted to explore all of that within that tension of that ticking clock. And so this is the first novel that I've ever had a ticking clock. And it's about 40 hours this novel takes place, counting down to that exact moment, 12 noon, January 20th.
And it is intriguing for someone who believes he's fairly well read in history to discover all these contradictions in the 1947 Act and the 20th Amendment.
Horrible. It's just the one example that's not in the novel. This shows you how bad the law is. We all know when the president dies and the vice president dies, the Speaker of the House becomes president. But what we're not taught in school is this. The Constitution specifically forbids a member of Congress from being president. So in order to become president, the Speaker must first resign the seat in Congress. When the Speaker resigns the seat in Congress, they're no longer Speaker. So they're not eligible to succeed.
Yes.
And that's exactly the way the law was written. They didn't fix that.
Yeah.
They didn't. They could have fixed it. There's a way to fix it, but they didn't do it. Mm-hmm. And they left that in there. If that ever actually happened, you'd have a mess on your hands. A giant mess on your hands.
As you would point out, because you mentioned some of these possibilities, and you said some people go for one, some go for the other. Will a Supreme Court step in? Will a House of Representatives step in?
Who
decides? Yeah. Who's got jurisdiction?
It's chaos.
Yeah.
And if the president-elect and the vice president-elect both die before they take the oath, which is what the novel does deal with, you've got a total constitutional mess.
Yes.
And that's what my bad guy is going to do. He's going to exploit that and give us the same chaos that we gave to his homeland in the Soviet Union and destroyed his way of life. He's been stewing on that for 25 years of how can I pay them back for what they did to me. And I based him on real KGB agents. I read their books. I read books about them. There are many of them out there stewing just like that.
Well, they had a pretty good setup there, as you point out.
Oh, yeah.
They had luxury items. They had stores that were open just for them. They had
access.
Yeah, great life. And nobody likes that. So, and these, unfortunately, are people with certain skill set that may have the ability to figure out to do something about that.
And they have knowledge. They have knowledge that we don't have, and that's where I got into some of the aspects of the Cold War that fascinated me, the suitcase-sized nuclear weapons, which 250 of those were supposedly produced by the Soviet Union. They've never been found to this day. And then the weapons caches that are located all over the world. And I put all that together, and it all began to gel into a novel that began to fit.
Well, one of the aspects that seems to also work out is how that can interact with institutional secrets from centuries ago that have a bearing on that. And that interplay is fantastic.
That's the tricky part. That's where it gets tricky because I call that the so what. Who cares if they have weapons? Who cares if this guy's mad? Who cares of all that? It has to matter today, and there's the catch. And then when I found the 20th Amendment, I said, well, this will be perfect. I can make it matter today.
Uh-huh.
And I can make it all fit. And that's the thing. I get that cool thing from history, which I call the ooh factor, that kind of ooh thing. And then I have the so what. Okay, you've got to have – I have to have both in order for the novel to work.
I think one of the things that I really appreciate as a reader is the writer's note at the end of the book, because you are so good at blending stuff when I'm not exactly certain which bits are real and which bits are adjusted for the story. And you very carefully separate those out at the end, which is greatly, greatly appreciated.
I do that. Yeah. I feel like what happens is a lot of people reading my books are getting history from them,
mm-hmm.
which is fine, except that I'm not a historian, and I'm a novelist. So I think it's fair for, it's only fair for me to tell them what I made up. Now, the cool thing about it is I try to keep the story about 90% to reality. I only have to trip it up a little bit. And in this book, I only had to make a few little adjustments,
right.
Just a few little trips up here and there to make the novel fit. And then I go through that novel very carefully, and I write that note. That note takes me about a week to write because I check everything in the book, line by line, to make sure I don't miss anything and to tell you exactly what's real and what's not, because you know, that's the bargain I make. I'm going to entertain you, but I'm also going to inform you, but I want to make sure you understand what was entertainment and what wasn't.
Right. And the frightening thing about it is, as it took so very few of those to make a very scary novel out of it.
Yeah, and that's the niche I've kind of carved for myself, to try to keep things as close to reality as possible. And I don't know of anybody else in the genre doing that. I think I'm about it. A lot of folks just make it up, or they make a huge adjustment in whatever it is.
Right.
I try to keep it as close as I can, and that's sort of my fame and my curse. It's a little bit of both.
It's a lot harder to do it that way, I suspect, than just
breaking it all. Yes, it's much harder, and that's the curse. Elizabeth gets on to me because she says, You dug that hole for yourself. You know, you went and got a big backhoe and you dug this big hole and you jumped down in it. And it's a very comfortable hole, but it's your hole. And so you can't complain. And I said, no, I agree. I can't complain.
Yeah. But people have liked it. So it's worked out well for you.
It has.
And as frankly, as readers, we sympathize with you having to work hard, but we're much more interested in reading what you put out, not how you got there.
Yeah, it just takes longer to do it this way. That's why it's an 18-month process to produce the novel. It's just a longer process that way. But it's a lot more fun in the end. You're right. Making it up is easier for me, but it's not as satisfying for the reader.
In your writing, I have got to say, I've interviewed a number of people who came from law into the spy thriller or courtroom drama. It seemed to be very popular. It seemed to be overrepresented as a profession in the population of writing. Do you think it's because your observance for detail is vital to both of those professions?
I think lawyers see a lot. I mean, and they get exposed to a lot, particularly trial lawyers. I was exposed to an enormous amount of things. I did thousands of divorces, and I just had all of that. But I had no desire to write about that. Most lawyers do write about what they do. When I teach writing, I make it very clear that writing what you know is very bad advice. I would never write what I know, ever. Instead, write what you love. Now, if what you know and what you love are the same thing, wonderful, but it wasn't for me. So I think lawyers want to tell those stories they come across, so legal thrillers naturally come out of them. You don't have many lawyers writing like I'm writing who went over into a totally different genre of an international suspense thriller. You don't see that very often. But that's what I loved. I loved action, history, secrets, conspiracies. And writing those and reading those was my way to escape the law, to get away from all those bad things.
And you talk about it. In one interview, you mentioned how you was just write that stuff down, discipline, write 1,000 words a day over and over again. And a couple of times you said you thought about giving up, but you didn't. And I think we're all very grateful for that.
That little voice in my head kept me going. I actually did quit about 3 times during that 12 years, but my quitting is only for a day or two. I just say, this is kind of ridiculous. This is not going anywhere. I'm just wasting my time. But then the little voice in my head would get back and say, come on, get back to work. And, we got to do this. Every writer I've met has that little voice that drives you crazy and tells you and keeps you writing. And it's just it's an annoying, nagging little voice. But it's the only thing that actually kept me going. Because, you can think about that. 12 years, 85 rejections. I mean, there's nothing fun about that.
No. One of the things that occurs to me is that you might have a milder version of it than, say, Isaac Asimov, who wrote 500-plus books, could not do much of anything else at that point.
No, that was his compulsion. But he certainly had the little voice in his head, going forward. And he was able to channel that and put it together. He was fortunate that he wrote at a time when the publishing business was much different than it is today. So he had the ability to write 500 books. Today, I don't know if that's possible anymore. I don't think anyone of that level like him could do that.
Yeah. And as you pointed out, that there's been continual consolidation, so there aren't as many doors to knock on to sell your work.
No, it's about seven publishers now, about seven or eight. And when I applied in the 90s, there were 18, so that shows you what's happened. The consolidation has changed the industry. The emergence of e-publishing has changed the industry. The emergence of Amazon has changed the industry. The industry is fundamentally, it's completely different in every respect than it was in 2003 when I broke in. It's not even the same. There's nothing similar to it whatsoever. It's how radical it is. And with today, with all of the stuff competing for your attention, you know, books are fighting to keep their place there.
Certain books don't have that much as a problem. I would say you'd be in that category. All right.
I hope so. I hope I've developed enough of an audience now that I can sustain whatever ups and downs come along. And that's certainly the goal that you shoot for, that you can sustain those, because the books go up and down, everything goes up and down. But I'm hoping that hole I carved out, I'm hoping it's my little hole and I get to keep it.
Well, one of the things that's going to drive it is the next book is going to have a different president involved there.
He will, yes. Danny's gone out of office, but he's not going away. Danny's coming back next book in a new job. He's going to have a brand new job, and he's going to be a lot more fun because he's going to be a point of view character next book. We're going to be in his head. We're going to hear his thoughts, and he was a lot of fun to write. The way he thinks and his wildness and things that he would do. But he has a brand new job, which is going to give him a lot more freedom. So I'm not getting rid of Danny Daniels. He's not going away at all. His relationship with Stephanie Nell is going to develop there a little more. And so there's a lot more coming for Danny. And the next book is called The Lost Order. Uh-huh. It will be out in April of next year. It's going to deal with the Smithsonian. I serve on the Smithsonian Libraries Advisory Board, so I'm very involved with the Smithsonian. And this book's going to deal with a lot of very interesting secrets from the Smithsonian and something from the Civil War that I think will surprise a lot of folks. And the reader is finally going to find out how Cotton got his name.
Uh-huh.
The story's going to deal with that. So you're going to learn how Cotton became Cotton.
Gee, and the only Cotton I can think of in history is Cotton Mather, and I'm sure there are others, but I'm not asking. I wouldn't want you to give it away until that.
No, I've always said it's a long story in every book, and it is. It's a whole novel, and you're going to find out a lot about Cotton next time. And it was a fun story. This year's book was my take on the spy novel.
Mm-hmm.
Next year's book is my take on the action adventure novel. There's politics in next year's book, but it's more action adventure. It's a flat out treasure hunt, fun treasure hunt for something, you know, very interesting from American history. And it was fun to write. It was just a good, fun story.
Well, I will be definitely looking for that next April. I want to mention a couple of things before we let you go. One of them is your website.
Yes, steveberry.org. Everything's there on me, the books. Find out anything you want to know there.
Yeah, and the fact that if you have enjoyed this conversation and you enjoy his work, you can pick up signed copies at VJ Books.
Yep, you get them there, and there the book is also available in stores everywhere in all formats, so check it out.
Indeed, indeed. A final thought, a couple of things that I've enjoyed are the Southern folk wisdom that I think always pretty much is in Danny's mouth, and one of them is that knowledge is knowing a tomato is a fruit. Wisdom is not putting it in fruit salad. Thank you for that.
There you go. That's an old Southern saying, and it hits it right on point.
All right. You have been very gracious with your time today. Any final thing you would like to mention to the fans out there?
No, just I hope they would give me, those of you who have not given me a try, give it a shot and take a look at the 14 Colony. If you like them, check out the others. I think you'll enjoy the stories.
Absolutely. And we've enjoyed our time with you today. Our guest has been Steve Berry. His latest is the 14th Colony. We await the one next year with great anticipation. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, sir.
You've been listening to Modern Sign Books on Blog Talk Radio with book specialist Roger Nichols. Be sure to check us out at modernsignbooks.blogspot.com.